Welcome back to Inside Personal Growth. This is Greg Voisin, the host of this podcast. And today on the line with me, I have Stephen Schwartz, and we're going to be talking to Stephen about Opening the Infinite, which is his new book. It's really, really quite interesting, mainly about remote viewing. Good day to you, Stephen. Where are you joining us from today?
Well, good day to you, Greg. I'm on Whidbey Island, where I live, and I'm glad to be with you.
Whidbey Island. I've spent a lot of time up in the Orcas Islands and at a meditation retreat there with Joel and Michelle Levy called Camp Indralaya. So you can't be that too far from there.
Not at all. And I know Joel and Michelle and lovely people.
Yeah. Well, let us tell our listeners a little bit about a little more about you. Stephen is the author of not only this book but many, many other books, but also the editor of the Schwartz Report, Trends That Will Affect Your Future. He sends that out on a regular basis. I just got yours the other day about healthcare trends and so on. This is a daily international web publication. Is in favor of the earth and interconnectedness and interdependence of life, democracy, liberty, and things that are life-affirming. Very, very good newsletter. I'll definitely highly recommend that to our listeners. Stephen also is a senior advisor to the Rhine Research Center and is the director of their research. He's also a columnist and contributing editor for Explore, the Journal of Science and Healing. And we're going to be speaking with him about his book called Opening to the Infinite, The Art and Science of Remote Viewing. He's also co-authored Virtual States and National Security, A Time for Reprisal, and author of Therapeutic Intent and The Art of Observation, Dr. Franklin's Plan, Disease of Distinction, and on and on and on. He's also was the project leader and research director of an expedition to Alexandria, Egypt in the 1979 and 80s, resulting in the first modern mapping of Eastern Harbor of Alexandria. You have a fascinating background, Stephen, and your newsletter is great. And today I want to focus in on this book. And, you know, it's interesting. You state that kind of there's an approach to this remote viewing, and in the initial part of the book, actually the introduction, you talk about 47 students that actually use this remote viewing technique to cap. Actually, it was during Saddam Hussein time, and they articulate that, you know, there was a high degree of accuracy around this remote viewing concept. Can you explain a little bit more what happened with those 47 students and really how accurate they were in the capture of Saddam Hussein and that story? I think our listeners would be interested.
Well, first let me say that remote viewing is a technique. You can think of it as a kind of modern mental martial art or a kind of mental yoga.
Uh-huh.
It's a way of opening to that part of yourself which is outside of space and time. And remote viewing is a protocol that I and some other people developed in the early 1970s. I was started in the late 60s. And it is a technique for opening to this part of yourself and getting objectively verifiable, highly detailed information
mm-hmm.
that you could not know through your normal senses because of shielding of space or time. So that's sort of the background of it. It's a technique, discipline.
Yep.
In this one you're interested in, the Saddam Hussein experiment, I was teaching a course at a college, and the students came up to me afterwards. These were not all young people. These were also some older and senior people in government and the intelligence agencies. I guess that's why they were interested in Saddam Hussein. And they came up to me and said, we'd like to do something really significant would give us information about something and would also show us that we have the ability to do this remote viewing. And so this was in November of 2003, and at the time, as everybody will remember, people were just looking everywhere for Saddam Hussein. I personally thought he had probably taken $1 billion or two and gone to some place like Saudi Arabia, like Idi Amin had done, and had, you know, was hiding in a safe house someplace. And in any case, I said, okay, I would do that. So I asked the 47 people. I took them through the technique that I describe in the book, Opening to the Infinite, and said, all right, I want you to go forward in time to the point where Saddam Hussein has been discovered by American or coalition troops. What do you see? And they went on to describe in very specific detail. They said he would be hiding in a kind of cave or hollowed out space that was under a little compound of houses. They drew a picture of the house. It had large palm trees at each end, that it had a river flowing behind it, a road in front of it, that he would only have a couple of people with him, that he would have a quantity of money with him, and that he would be dispirited and would put up no resistance, and, which I found particularly interesting, he would look like a homeless person and would be dressed in dark clothing and would have a wild hairdo and a wild salt and pepper beard. Now, if you remember back to Saddam Hussein, you'll note that he was always a very notably fastidious person about his personal hygiene. People talked about it at the time. He was always impeccably turned out. I mean, you might not like his style, but he was always very well turned out. And he was something of a germaphobe. So the story that they told, just, I thought, it can't possibly be true. How could this guy look like a homeless person, crouched down in a little hole under a building, and just two or three people with him? And I, you know, it just didn't make any sense. But I did the analysis and developed the conclusions, the hypothesis from which field work could be carried out. And I then turned it over to the rector, or the director of the university, who had it all notarized and sealed and put in a bank vault so that there would be an unimpeachable chronology of prediction and actual discovery. That is, nobody could argue that the material had not been provided prior to the discovery. And then I just waited. And then about a month later, in December, about 6 weeks, I think it was, they announced that they had caught him, and they, in the subsequent press conferences, they reported that, in fact, as everybody will remember, he had been crouched down in what they called a spider hole. It had a vent shaft, just like the vent shaft the remote viewers had described. The building looked exactly like they had described it. It had the two palm trees at the end. It had the road in the front, the river in the back, and they had said it was in a village near the city of Tikrit, and it was in the village of Adwar, which is right outside of Tikrit, just as they had described, and on. I mean, there were a series of about 40 distinct, discrete statements that they consensually agreed on, all of which turned out to be exactly correct.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, this is the same technique that I used to locate Cleopatra's palace and Mark Antony's palace, the Timonium, the lighthouse of Pharos, sunken ships. This is the same technique that the CIA used to do a kind of spying, non-local remote viewing spying on the Soviet Union, using the lab up at SRI in Palo Alto to do it. So these techniques have been widely used at universities and institutions, laboratories around the world, and have had an extremely good track record.
Well, obviously, it's very well documented in your book, and I just want to acknowledge you on that. One of the things, I happened to be watching a PBS special, and I saw a partial interview with you about Edgar Cayce. Now, you mentioned about Edgar Cayce, and for those listeners out there, I would say many of them know of his parapsychology and his abilities, and he used to kind of lay there and people would ask him questions, and he would be able to kind of project himself and actually almost I mean, he was an incredible degree of accuracy. Do you believe he was using a remote viewing or what? What?
Yes.
Because you made
exactly the same thing.
Okay.
He didn't do it in exactly the same way. He developed his own discipline.
Mm-hmm.
Edgar Cayce was born into a fundamentalist Christian family, and he found what he was doing very uncomfortable, and I think that's why the way he did it is he went into a kind of sleep state so that he didn't remember what he had said, and I think that's probably true because he said a lot of things which in his waking state he would have found very uncomfortable. I mean, he was talking about reincarnation, for instance, and being a fundamentalist Christian, that wouldn't have been a very comfortable thing to talk about. Cayce was, I think, probably the best example we have of an individual's ability to open to this part of himself, the non-local consciousness part. He is extraordinarily well documented. I mean, they're literally, he gave thousands of readings, about 15,000 of these sessions, and there was exhaustive follow-through with them, all of which is recorded at the ARE in Virginia Beach.
Yeah.
Anybody that's interested can just go to edgarcayce.org, it's all there.
Well, and I've been there. He finally died almost from exhaustion from all the readings that he'd done.
Yes, he in a sense committed suicide in service. He was told he could give two of these sessions a day, and he was during the war, the need was so great that he was giving as many as 16, so I think he just killed himself in service. But all of it has been carefully recorded. There are other people who are somewhat similar, although not as well documented, and I don't think quite as gifted. I mean, people today think of Cayce as a kind of second Nostradamus, but there's no question that he is the father of holistic medicine. He was talking about the importance of exercise and diet and giving specific recommendations about it way back in the 1920s. And over time, his recommendations have proven to be highly correct, and his recommendations about lifestyle are today recognized as the optimal way to conduct one's life.
Yeah, he was fascinating. And the show you were on the PBS, it was, for all of our listeners, it's fascinating. I think if you go to his website, you'll probably be able to pick up on that, or maybe you have some way people can actually rewatch that. It was a very good special.
I know the one you're talking about. I was just one of the people interviewed.
Okay.
No, I don't know how to get it. The ARE may have it up on their website, but
yeah.
There are lots and lots of books. The best of the books about Edgar Cayce is Sidney Kirkpatrick's An American Prophet. That's the best of the biographies.
Oh, good.
But he is a very interesting person, but what's particularly interesting, Greg, is that he may be the Tiger Woods of remote viewing.
Mm-hmm. I thought that, yeah.
Yeah, but what we know from the research is that almost anybody can do this.
Well, yeah, you mention in your book, which I think is really, you clarify these terms, and, you know, I've talked to other people, Diane Hennessy Powell and the ESP Enigma and so on, really telepathy, clairvoyance, clairaudience, and clairascension. Now, you helped to give a definition in your book about that, but many people have this. They feel things, they pick up on things, and we're going to get to the steps involved in remote viewing in a minute, but for our audience, tell us what your belief is currently about everybody's ability to tap into one of these various senses.
Well, I need to say to you, Greg, that it's not about my opinions. I mean, my opinions are maybe interesting, but not ultimately dispositive. What really matters is the data of the research. So the things that I'm saying are the result of experimental research in which, under very tightly controlled conditions, we have done this literally thousands of times, and mm-hmm. so we have some sense of how it works. So I want to stress that this is not speculation. I'm not trying to start some new metaphysical school or anything. This is based on experimental, double-blind, randomized research.
What
we know about that is that, as I interpret this material, is that all of us have a let's think of it as a channel of an aspect of our own consciousness which exists outside of space and time. This is the part that has hunches. This is the part that has precognitive dreams. This is the part that is we call women's intuition. This is the part that survives after bodily death. This is the part that is worked with in meditation. So this is a perfectly normal aspect of your consciousness.
There's nothing paranormal about it.
There's nothing occult about it. There's nothing weird about it. Everybody can do this. It's spread through the population in about the same way that any other human ability is. That is, there is a small group of people at one end of the continuum who are really gifted, Edgar Cayce, and there are a few people at the other end who either will not or cannot give themselves permission to open to this part of their consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And most of us fall somewhere in the middle. That's why we call it a bell curve. So the first thing you want to know is you can do it.
Yeah, everybody can do this.
Everybody can do this.
Yeah, and you have steps.
Everybody can
book,
do this.
So
just as everybody can send healing to another person, there are really basically two kinds of phenomena that involve non-local consciousness. That is, consciousness which is not sited entirely in your brain. And the two phenomena are non-local perception, that's remote viewing. That would also encompass all those old terms of telepathy and clairvoyance, and those are really old-fashioned terms. We don't use them much anymore.
So you call it non-local awareness, right?
Non-local awareness,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
And the other one is non-local perturbation, which is the idea that consciousness can have an effect on physical reality, and that is the underlying phenomena that is behind healing prayer, distance healing, all of that. So what it's telling us is that you have aspects of yourself which for cultural reasons you are probably not terribly aware of. Most people aren't. But that you use these things, you just call them hunches or intuitions or I had a gut feeling. And what the remote viewing or the therapeutic intention stuff is doing is simply giving people a discipline to learn how to express this part of themselves in the same way that you have an innate ability to play a musical instrument, but you can't really play the instrument until you develop the discipline of whatever that instrument is.
Well, one of the things you say, Stephen, is that a constant meditator obviously is a good way to go deeper into this practice, of which I am and many of my listeners are. But the other thing is this discernment. I mean, some of us feel something, some of us, we don't know if it's real or not. I think that's really kind of the line. You actually give a process to go through where you take a pad and a paper and you close your eyes and you go into it. Can you actually, for our listeners, kind of define the remote viewing process and how we would practice that?
Yes, sure.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you exactly how to do it.
Okay.
Here's a protocol. You can do it yourself.
Okay.
And it will demonstrate to you that that you can do it and that no other explanation will explain what has happened.
Okay.
So here's how you do it. We need two people. One person is going to be the monitor and one person is going to be the experiencer.
Do you have to have a
monitor?
No,
you don't, but just for the sake of this experiment I'm going to explain.
Okay.
You can do this with your wife or your husband or your kids or a good friend, or it doesn't matter.
Okay.
It just makes it a little simpler for this.
Okay.
So, let's first talk about the person who's the monitor. They're basically going to be the interviewer. And so what the monitor has to do is to ask the experiencer, and let's, for the sake of the illustration, let's say that the target is going to be a physical object, something you can hold in your hand. So what the monitor says to the experiencer is, okay, I want you to close your eyes, take a deep breath, let it out, take a deep breath, let it out, take a deep breath, let it out, let your mind be clear, you're relaxed. I now want you to put out your dominant hand. That's the hand you write with or that you use most of the time. Put out your hand. I'm going to put in your hand this object. Now, I don't know what the object is right now. Nobody knows, because the target object at the moment that the experiencer is providing the information does not yet exist as a target. So there is absolutely no way either the monitor or the experiencer can cheat. So the monitor says to the experiencer, put out your hand, I'm going to put this object in, and then it's as if the object were physically in your hand. You say, well, squeeze the object. Is it hard? Is it soft? Run your fingers over it. Does it have a texture or is it smooth? Look at the object. Does it have a particularly dominant color? Is the object made out of one piece or several pieces? Does the object have a smell? Put it next to your ear and shake it. Do you hear any sound? Does anything about this object move? Is this object older than 10 years, older than 50 years, older than 100 years, whatever? So you get all of this information, which the monitor writes down as the experiencer says it.
Okay.
So now you have all the information.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have all the information and you've got it, all the session's over, then the monitor goes to a third person, could be anybody in the household, and says, pick an object you can hold in your hand. Now, I want to stress this again. At the time that the experiencer is describing the object, it does not exist as a target.
What does not exist as a target mean? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it exists as a physical object, but it has not been designated as the target.
Okay,
so I'm going to show you an object in an hour. Okay, Greg, I'm going to show you an object in an hour. I have no idea what the object is.
Okay, good. In other words, there's no information about the object, nor has it been disclosed by the person doing the remote.
There's no way to cheat.
Okay, got it.
There's no way to inadvertently cue. There's no way to cheat. Nothing, because at the time that the experiencer is describing the object, it does not exist as a designated target. So once you get all the data, which you've written all down, it's all been written down, then the monitor goes to another person and says, basically, select an object that you can hold in your hand. It can be anything.
Mm-hmm.
Anything. Then what you do is ask, when this third person has made this, they've chosen the object, then they give you that information. And the monitor picks six other objects, or five other objects, and several other objects. We're trying to get statistical significance, but that's not so important here.
Right.
Pick several other objects, and you give them to another person, and you say, is the description that I'm giving you, which is the data you got from the session, I want you to read this data that the experiencer has provided, and I want you to match it up to the target. Is it most like this object? Is it most like this object? Is it most like this object? And if the judge matches the information to the target object and doesn't match it to the other objects that are sort of the controls, then you have had a successful example of opening to non-local awareness, because your description, which you have provided an hour or so earlier, which is about an object which doesn't exist as a designated target, has been independently judged to be so accurate that on the basis of your description, the judge can discern whether your description is about the correct object. So just to give you an example of what I'm talking about, suppose the you've gotten the data, and let's say that the experiencer says, well, it's orange and silvery. It has several parts. There's one end of it. You can take things off and put other things on. It's some kind of tool. Has texture when I hold it. It has no smell. I don't hear anything when I shake it. So, okay, we now have that data. We go to the person who's going to pick the target, and let's, for the sake of the illustration, let's say that they take a orange and steel screwdriver that has a removable tip, and we then ask another person to select three other objects, and they select a tennis ball and a pencil or a scissors. And then we show it to the information to the judge. We give him the pencil, or the scissors, and we give him the tennis ball, and we give him the screwdriver, and we say, reading this information, which object is being described? And he says, well, it's very clearly the screwdriver that has an orange handle and a steel tip, and it has this removable, so you can put different kinds of screwdriver tips on it. Mm-hmm. Now, the only way that can happen is that the experiencer has to move forward in time to the moment where the object is selected, and they have to be able to obtain highly detailed descriptive material about that object from the future. And if you do this, and anybody can do it, you can do it at home, you can do it around the dinner table, what you are experiencing is that part of yourself which exists outside of space and time.
Fascinating, fascinating explanation of it. I think for our listeners, hopefully they got that. But if they didn't, can you, Stephen, explain where they can go to find out more information about this, your website, your newsletter, the things that you kind of delve in on a regular basis?
Sure. If you go to stephanaschwartz.com, that's S-T-E-P-H-A-N, it's just Stephen with an A, Stephan A. Schwartz, S-C-H-W-A-R-T-Z.com. You'll go to that's my personal website. You'll see my books and my CDs. Also, you can download my papers, my scientific papers, my essays, all kinds of things. You can order books and CDs if you're interested in it. I give a lot of stuff away for free, so you don't have to pay anything. You can download all the papers for free, all that sort of stuff. So StephanAschwartz.com, and the other is my daily web publication, which is SchwartzReport.net.
Well,
and that is a daily web publication which describes the trends which are shaping the future.
It's fascinating, this remote viewing. And I'd love to have you back on again. We only do half-hour shows, but just after speaking with you for the short period, it flew by. So I always know when stuff kind of just moves by like that, it's an opportunity to go deeper. And I don't feel like
sure.
We quite had the opportunity to go as deep as I would like to. So I'd actually like to invite you to come back on again
sure.
And share with our listeners some more, because you're very prolific in your reading, and I like your approach. It's not... it's very scientific in nature, your double-blind studies. So for those people who are potentially skeptical about this, I'd highly recommend you get on Stephen's newsletter, you go to his website, you pull down some of his research papers, because this is an area, Stephen, that a very small percentage of the population deals in, as you know. But the reality
sure.
is this world could be a much more... aware place if people would expand their consciousness to these ideas. And I just want to acknowledge you for the work you've done for years in this area and opening up people's minds and consciousness to this.
My pleasure. It was a pleasure to talk to you, Greg, and I'll be glad to do it again.
Okay. I appreciate it very much, and we'll talk again soon. Thanks.
Bye-bye.